Hi, this is Clint Broussard. You're listening to KPFT Houston. Have you noticed a lack of country music in the Houston airwaves? Well, I'm excited to announce that we have a new HD3 channel that is all classic country all the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Just when you thought you missed something, well, there's something to find as well. It's our HD3 channel here at KPFT Houston.
Hi, I'm Mel.
And I'm Ro.
We're from Shame on Me.
And you're listening to KPFT Houston.
Hey, good evening. It's Wednesday, time for Living Art. I'm Michael Woodson, and you're listening to 90.1 FM, 89.5 Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville, and wherever you are that you have a signal, kpft.org. So glad you joined us tonight. It's great to have you with us. Tonight we have two guests. We're going to talk poetry tonight, but before we do that, I want to give the audience a chance to hear the person who makes it all happen in the control room. Good evening, my co-host Blue.
Trying my best. Hey, and I'm here. I'm still loving the Wednesdays, and even more excited for what's happening this week. What's happening specifically tomorrow? Tomorrow is the first day of our. Is it spring or winter?
I think it's winter.
It was cold today. I'm not too sure. Winter.
Let's call it winter.
Our winter 2025 pledge drive here at KPFT. So that's when we're going to start pitching and asking for donations. But it's because this thing has been going on for 55 years. 55 years coming up in March?
55 big years.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And even with my involvement in just coming up on 1 year, it's been an amazing place for me to be, an amazing thing that I know that I'm contributing to. And it feels good being here. So I'm more than happy to, you know, stick around and see what's going on in Pledge Drive. Exciting stuff, you know?
Well, we're more lucky than you are to have you.
Aww.
Yeah. If you want to donate, get a jump on that and tag Living Art 713-526-5738. Also on kpft.org, just click donate and throw us a little bit of generosity so that we get a jump. And we're looking good by way of fundraising. Anyway, we don't have to do that today. What we're doing today is talking poetry. We have two guests, Kelly Ellis and Kimberly Hall. Welcome to Living Art.
Thank you, Michael.
Hi, thanks.
So let's just start. Kelly, tell us a little bit about yourself in Houston.
Okay, well, I am a co-founder of a nonprofit called Hot Poet. And we started during the pandemic. We published a book for it was a posthumous collection for Glenn Monroe Irby, and four of us came together and as a committee curated this book. And so, in order to do that, we formed this nonprofit, Hot Poet, and our mission was to support writers and artists and to build community. And my partner, Tina Cardona, and I had been doing that for some time, throwing events and, sort of building community in our own small way with our solstice parties. So when we published the book, we were thinking about what to do next, and we started a journal called Equinox. And the solstice parties were sort of founded on the idea that people should be passionate about their writing, to write with passion, And we called ourselves Hot Poet because anyone can be a hot poet as long as they are passionate about what they write. So we founded this journal called Equinox, and it comes out twice a year. It comes out in the fall and in the spring. It's always thematic. The current theme is Inner Chambers, Secret Rooms, and the call for submissions just ended, so it'll be released on the spring equinox, March 21st, and that's how I met Kimberly, was through that journal, because Kimberly started submitting work to Equinox, and the first year that she submitted, she won our contest. We have a contest that offers a $100 prize in short prose, poetry, and art, and Kimberly won that year in prose, and then the next year, Kimberly won again in poetry, and at that time, we started talking about maybe her doing a collection with us, and so just last year, we published Kimberly's collection, Honey Locust, and so that's why we're on the air together tonight, because she's the writer, and I'm the publisher of that book.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Kimberly.
Well, I am not actually a poet by trade, necessarily. Mm-hmm. I don't have an English degree or anything. I am a scientist by heart. But I started writing poetry very seriously after our local library in Friendswood is where I grew up. Has started doing ekphrastic poetry contests most years. And I started submitting to that as a way to, it was sort of therapeutic. Hmm. A few years ago, you know, when COVID hit, started writing really seriously. Again, sort of therapeutic in a way that sort of needed to externalize sort of the way that everything had seemed to internally collapse when COVID hit. So I started writing really seriously and sending things out to publishers. And that's how I ran into Kelly, through Equinox. I was very flattered when my sort of prose poem won the prose contest. I was even more flattered when Honey Locust won the poetry contest. I about died inside when she asked if I wanted to do a collection. And so I spent the last, because I didn't intend to sort of, I didn't set out writing poetry to try to write a collection, publish books. But yeah, I spent the last year or so sort of curating what poetry I had written, writing some more things to sort of tie them all together. And yeah, in December it came to fruition.
I guess you wanted to read the title piece?
Yeah, I can read the title piece.
You want Honey Locust?
Honey Locust. The Honey Locust is a kind of tree that we have locally. It's known for having a very sort of sweet smell when it blossoms. It smells like honey, hence the name. But it's also known for having these wicked huge thorns. So you use it, they're used a lot in sort of fencing to sort of keep herbivores and pests out of, you know, sort of curated garden areas, because they have these huge thorns. And that's the sort of, that's the image that I want to evoke through this poem. So, Honey Locust. It's the smell that draws me in first, always. All sweet tea and ozone, hard candy, the kind of smell that clings to your teeth and stains your tongue red, and then the light where the sunset reaches like fingers through darkened limbs, or little eyes of fiery needles all strung and laced together. Strange, isn't it? The places we return to when we want to feel safe. The places that return to us. There is no land built for outcasts, after all, not really. There's only ecological drift. There's only a transformation of what it means to be cast out. At the edge of the thicket, That is the edge of the world, which is itself its own compass, a view into nature of nature. The honey locust does not wilt beneath the sun's reproachful glare, nor wither from the root when rain clouds turn their backs. The honey locust offers shelter to the fox and shield to the shrike and succor to the insects who hover in anticipation of a feast. Everyone in the thicket knows what it means to spill blood, to be held by thorns, to heed the honeyed breakdown of border and loam, its siren call into the red and the green and the dark. The fox and the shrike, the blowflies, the honey locust and me, proud shoulders set against the sky, all of us, our gnarled roots and palms like spines, our outcast hearts, we grow what we need to survive.
Great. What kind of world are you anticipating or projecting or experiencing in that poem?
Well, it's the sensation of sort of being sort of socially outcast. So I'm gay. This is a poem about being gay. That's the simplest way to put it. There's often the idea of queerness as being something that's unnatural. And so it gets sort of pushed to the outcast of society. I wanted to evoke this idea of, to sort of reject that idea. Sort of evoke this sense of outcastness as being something that can thrive, rather than something that should be ignored.
Yes, I love how you have these different mentions to these natural things, whether it be the thicket or the fox or these beautiful things in nature. And it goes back to what struck me most was the gnarled roots. All of this is like, it's natural, it's real, it's here, there's things that, like the nature of the honey locust, I feel like it's kind of a juxtaposition with how sweet the fragrance is. And when it blooms, it's this experience, but also this, what it is with these thorns, you know? I feel like it painted a very naturalistic and beautiful picture, drawing back to nature.
Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly what I was sort of wanting to project.
Yeah, there's such a strength to it, and it kind of goes in two ways. You don't know if the image is that their shelter with the thorns, or the creatures who are protected or thorny, because they're not real. It's not like a butterfly or something, right? It's a fox, and
yeah, it's they're sort of the particular animals that I picked, even to sort of feature in this poem, are animals that we kind of like to shun. In sort of civilized society, you know, foxes, they go through trash and they sort of scavenge on people's, like on tiny animals, and blowflies exist only to sort of feed on corpses. But these are things that are necessary for, the sort of ecological, health of an environment.
What drew you to it, Kelly?
Well, I thought that Kimberly's poetry was so enticing. It was almost seductive. The issue that she was submitting to was, the theme was Into the Thicket. And so to me, the thicket is a very complex area. There's layers and layers of life, and it's teeming with, you know, all kinds of things, but it also has sort of a mythological place, you know, that's where the outlaws are, that's where the magic is. With the first poem in this book, it was the first poem in the issue that she submitted to, and it was called Into the Thicket. And so I thought that it just drew me in a way that was, it was sensory, it was lush, beautiful, and it just fit the theme so well. So that's why those two had prominent places in that issue.
Yeah, and another thing I noticed is that she doesn't mess around with her associations. For example, when she brings up the blowfly feeding on corpses, you can tell that that's really thought out. And because of that, the reader earns a kind of, or grants a kind of trust to the writer, and will go ahead and enjoy the poetry at that level, too.
Yeah, I think something that I try to internalize while I'm writing is I want to write something that feels honest and that feels real, sort of something that you can experience as a sensory experience, not just sort of intellectual, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I feel like it definitely painted a picture for me to be able to see these very visual things or these very visceral things, you know, where it's not only what I know, but what the scene you've painted for us.
I don't want it to just sort of wash over your head, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I want you to feel it.
Can I ask what experiences have you gone through that have contextualized feeling like an outcast? And if you could speak to a little bit about that with maybe, you know, the queer community here in Houston. Are you a Houston native, or where are you from?
I very technically am from Louisiana. I didn't spend very long there. Yeah, I'm an Army kid, so I spent time overseas when I was a kid. When I was little, my family lived in South Korea. But we moved back here to Friendswood. I live in Friendswood. When we came back to the United States. So I've lived here most of my life. And it's one of those things.
Do you feel like the way you've come into Houston or gotten more into the art scene here, whether it was through publishing or learning that you like to write poetry, how has that kind of journey been for you?
Very stressful. I won't lie. It's hard to know how much of yourself you're willing to share with people. Especially in, you know, I know Houston is not necessarily emblematic of that, but Texas is sort of has a deeply conservative culture. So it's difficult to judge how much of yourself you can share while staying safe at the same time as being honest. It's been a challenge navigating that on a personal level. I find the arts community has been very accepting, but I don't know that that's uncommon for arts communities. It's difficult to know how your work is going to be received in certain environments. The political climate right now, who knows if anyone at a public school would be allowed to have my book, because I say very specifically that, you know, I'm queer. I'm not going to hide that when it comes to my writing.
Yeah, I think with poetry in general, there's a different respect I have because you are being so vulnerable. You're trying to evoke something out of someone else that is real. So what you have to put forth is true to who you are. So it's definitely a different respect I have for the people that share pieces of their life with the arts. And I know Houston is a little interesting because of the nature of the state, of how conservative and just the things that underscore Texas. But when you get to here in Houston, whether it be somewhere like Friendswood or here on Caroline Street, it's just such a weird, like, duality to the culture here.
Yeah, it is really interesting going outside of Houston and sort of trying to sort of contextualize what your life is like in the Houston area, being so different from everywhere outside of Houston.
There are hostile spaces.
Yeah. It's, and you just have to, you know, you just have to be smart and take care of yourself first.
That's crazy. Hostile, you're 18, right? You're free to love who you want to love, aren't you?
I would say so.
I don't get the hostility.
I would say so.
That's the way it should be. And it just feels like, you know, whether legislation, we could talk about legislation, we could talk about culture, we could talk about, you know, whatever. But what's important is the space that you occupy, the people that you're around, you know, the culture that you have in your small circle. Is how do you feel taking up space? So, yeah, I think Houston's art scene is, well, like you said, any art scene, it's definitely a little more empathetic to the human condition and to the differences that we all have. But specifically here in Houston, I know there's so many different avenues through which artists find themselves identifying with, you know, local independent group, grassroots groups, or, you know, now we're getting more of the bigger industry side of things where Houston's kind of being put on a map, whether it be through publishing routes or, you know, stuff that's going on social media. So definitely.
You're listening to Living Art on KPFT Houston, a safe space. It's been a safe space for 55 years, I'm happy to say. Followed by Queer Voices, I might add, in context to what we're talking about. And our guests tonight are Kelly Ellis and Kimberly Hall. Maybe, Kelly, we'll go back to you for some poetry. But first, why don't you talk about how people can find the book?
Oh, so... we have a website, hotpoet.org, and we sell the book on that website. And we also, Kimberly has copies, I have copies, and we're looking to make it more widely available and to do some local readings. Kimberly's going to be our guest for First Friday's reading series in June, and she'll have books there. First Fridays is the longest running reading series in Houston. It's almost as old as KPFT. So anyway, it's and I'm really honored and privileged to be one of the hosts for that. Every month on the first Friday,
right.
And we have a featured reader as well as a mystery poet that is a surprise that night. And Kimberly's our featured reader in June, so it'll be the first Friday in June. And then there's an open mic, and people, it's always been a hub for, you know, people from all over Houston. So it's a very welcoming place, too. And we get a real cross-section of poets, and it's quite diverse and fun.
Well, if the listeners don't know it, Kelly Ellis is just really an anchor or something, a great networker of poets in the city. I think she's one of those people who know everybody, and everybody knows her. But let's talk about your book, the Hungry Ghost Diner. Other projects, I don't know what you want to land on here.
I published this book in 2023. I didn't publish it. Lamar University Literary Press published it, and I was really grateful for that.
Oh, good.
I put the manuscript together during the pandemic, and the gist of the book is it revolves around different types of hungers that people have, you know, hunger for relationships, for acceptance, hunger to cross class boundaries. And it's also kind of Houston-centric as well, because I write a lot about this city. And
I really like that about it, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. So I had a couple of Houston poems I wanted to read when we get to it. And I've enjoyed having it out, and people seem to respond well to it. I have a new manuscript I'm trying to send out. It's called Wrong Tree Barking, and it's about living with mistakes I've made. So that puts me in a vulnerable place. But so I have that, and then I have a book that I'm working on. It's a hybrid book called, it's creative nonfiction as well as poetry. It's called A is for Armageddon. And it's about growing up and being indoctrinated in a very evangelical religion. So
end of times.
Yeah. So so I have those two projects going on right now, and like I said, I have the journal, which takes a lot of time.
I got to tell you, when I read the Hungry Ghost Diner, your book, I thought I made that mistake, and I would read another one. Yeah, I've been there, so it's very experience based. And what flesh out this idea of hunger that you were saying? You had other facets of it.
Well, my friend Cindy Heiser asked me what most of my poems, what the overarching theme for my poetry was, and I said, I think it's discontent. And she said, oh, like a hungry ghost. And I had never heard of the hungry ghost, but the hungry ghost is a Buddhist incarnation, and the ghost cannot leave the earthly plane because it is perpetually hungry, but it can never get enough to satisfy its hunger. So if you look at images of the hungry ghost, they're very dark, so I wanted to make it a little more lighthearted and a little more local, so I added
like
diner.
The ghost wants to hang around a while.
Yeah, so the Hungry Ghost Diner sort of implies a place, but it could also imply a hungry ghost who is trying to dine, and so trying to get fed and satisfy that hunger.
Well, sock it to us, man. Tell
okay,
us.
Well, this is a Houston poem that people seem to like. It's called Drinking Bitters. Drinking Bitters. The lure of the $5 glass of Chianti plus olives, brie, and my 5 o'clock munchies make for unhappy hour at the Rainbow Lodge. The terrace gardens, the 80s pop trio, that wedding sweating the garden below, I do's limp as a blown over rose, another corsage left in the sun. I hate Khalil Gibran. Hate every Sufi, really, anyone who dances to ecstasy, including Lady Gaga, especially Madonna. Though I looked like her, blooming, once upon a corset, or so I was told. She's still hot thanks to mantras, yoga, personal trainers, sex, and imbibing the blood of like a virgin. Now I might be sweaty, but hot I'm not. Let the Chianti breathe. That's right, breathe right through my pores. These flowers are wilting like a worn-down libido. I should have ordered a dirty martini. Campari. Something bitter to beat the heat. I hate Texas. Hate happy couples. Hate sitting under live oaks alone. This was a bad idea. I'm tipping maybe 10%. Can you break a dollar? I asked the waiter. Someone bought your drinks, he says. Where? Over there. But the buyer is gone. Moved on. Good deed done. My thighs are chafing, my heart, a 5-pound Fabergé stone, plunked in the Monet look-alike pond, where the bride gazes, wistful, fistful of lilies.
You see what I mean? Yeah, it's very powerful. Aging is not for the faint of heart. I mean, I don't know what to say without projecting some of my own, you know, moments. Yeah, but it's such honesty.
Well, thank you.
Don't you think,
I'm glad
or
you
not?
Liked it. Yes, I mean, I think I don't know how to not be honest in my writing.
You can just imagine not really feeling like having a drink, but you go out. I don't know, maybe she's sitting by herself, right? And like thinking, I really don't want to be here because like I'm not feeling very good. And you know, like the drink's not going to do it, and all these thoughts are coming through her brain. It's just so
yeah.
Such
I
a
think
moment.
I found myself identifying with the idea of a ghost that's hungry, but like for a life force, this vitality, this drive to live and to be, you know, to enjoy your life or to do those things that go out and make you feel like you're, you know, doing something good or enjoyable with your time. I got that idea of a life force.
Well, I have different poems that deal with different types of hungers, like I said, and recently I've been writing a lot about how Houston is changing and, you know, people are being pushed out of neighborhoods by gentrification, which is really happening in my neighborhood. So that's been a preoccupation lately with my writing, is just kind of giving voice to those places that are disappearing.
Definitely. That's one of the things. That, and this is why Mike is laughing, because that's one thing that I can get so riled up with gentrification, and how something truly, you know, there's new things that come in, but there's something that's not quite right. There's something that's lost. There's a certain essence of what was that becomes so important and identifiable of a place, or, you know, just that idea of the essence of something, whether it be how it lives and breathes or its culture.
Well, I have another one that I'd like to share if we have time. It's called Forgotten Houston, and it's really about my neighborhood. I live in Independence Heights, and in the last 4 or 5 years, there have been 8 housing complexes, like townhouses, that have gone in on my street, and so houses are getting torn down right and left. But there are still some holdouts, like my house, and there are still like there are still some feral chickens running around the neighborhood. And
really, so, when I lived there, there was a guy with pigeons across the street.
I remember when I used to have chickens in my house when I was little.
Well, this is called Forgotten Houston. If I can read this one,
yeah.
Okay, Forgotten Houston. The feral chickens clucking behind my house grub for grubs in the abandoned graveyard, or sometimes idle with sex workers outside the Valero. So when the rooster crows, it's really a rooster, Bluestown notwithstanding. At the tip-top of Independence Heights, the boot of Acres Homes, west of North Freeway, east of Garden Oaks, I once saw a woman take a piss on the sidewalk, dress hiked, haunches bare, and I envied her. I mean, who hasn't been desperate to pee at an inopportune time? Plus, these walks are too clean now. Who stands proud in a teardown, butt up against those fancy condos sprouting all over like mushrooms in manure? But the trailer park still snubs its nose at the new landed gentry, and the horses lose their minds on Christmas Day and New Year's Eve and the 4th of July, when drunk uncles fire arms at starless skies. Or maybe it's a shootout, you never know. Dogs bark either way. You can't sleep no matter whether someone bleeds out or just staggers into the gutter. These dogs run the streets, and I mean run, as in the big dog, the straw boss. You better run. Carry a big stick when you walk our block. Talk to folks about getting out to vote. You don't know nothing about these streets. Don't know what side your belt is buckled on. Us chickens will be here long after you're gone. We got plenty of poverty to sharpen our beaks. Grub for the pecking to chow down on. That homeless guy outside the new Whole Foods hammers at your window, demands change, and you give him all you've got, the easy reach into your bulging pockets, those deep, deep pockets of change.
That's what you see going on in your neighborhood. So you have a lot of kind of people, you know, an image of resistance and actually inevitable survival.
Yeah. For the chickens and for the people, you know, I just feel sad about the way Houston is changing, and, you know, people who have money are able to just take over whole neighborhoods. And there is a housing shortage, yes, but there's also, you know, the people who have lived in those neighborhoods for years and years, you know, generations of people that are being kind of pushed out by this gentrification.
Definitely. And even if I own my house, you know, okay, I own my house and I've owned it for the past, what, maybe 40, 50 years. I'm older. I'm on passive retirement income. I can't keep up with the property taxes of, you know, the new Whole Foods that came in, the new, you know, cafe, the new trendy little thrift shop or something. And a lot of those people that are so just instrumental to the culture of what was there and what started this neighborhood in Houston, whether it be like your neighborhood in Independence Heights or me and my personal experience in Second Ward, it's changing. It's even if I'm not displaced physically, if I stay in that house, it's a kind of mental displacement where your world is kind of shifting. Things are different. Things like, you know, the way you feel about walking down your street or the way you feel about the space that you used to, that used to be different.
Yeah, you were talking about the shops, mm-hmm. and the restaurants, you know, the dry cleaners, the gas stations, all of that was owned by, you know, people you knew, you're familiar with it. Then all of a sudden there's a town home on a lot that mm-hmm. you used to, you know, go to have lunch at.
The best torta that you could find in Second Ward at Gita's Cafe. Well, maybe I can't say that, but it's not there anymore. Is the point. Mm. It doesn't matter. It's and you'll never know that if you moved there, you know? It's I think I find this theme of spaces and things that juxtapose each other. Things that are happening now and this feeling inside that doesn't really, you know, connect with what's going on around you. Can both of you speak a little bit to how these personal feelings inside, whether you feel like an outcast or whether you feel this kind of mental displacement in the midst of gentrification, how, you know, you can speak to the resilience of occupying space and being comfortable saying, hey, this is me, I'm here. I can take up this space and use that with your art, whether it be poetry or other things you're writing.
At a certain point, I think comfort is not really the point. Like, your own comfort is not really the point. It's, there's, when it comes to, you know, like, there's a certain time when you can occupy space and it's comfortable and it's easy, and no one around you is gonna try to push back against it, and we are no longer living in those times. So it's not really about comfort necessarily. It's like when you're using art to sort of assert your own place in a certain space, then sometimes the point is to make the people in power uncomfortable. There's like to remind them that there's a whole sort of world of people out there that they are sort of in a certain way beholden to. Is when you, is how it should be, I think. So when you have the kind of sort of economic power in a certain space, then you should have that sort of responsibility to uplift that space. But that's not what happens in real life. So it's like what Kelly said, when the, you know, the feral chickens are going to survive, and people are going to survive because people are resilient. And it's, but there's a whole sort of subset of people who aren't gonna who are going to push back on that. So it's important to sort of show up anyway.
Yeah, just by being, just by occupying space, or you know, your existence at the very, very, like, you know, okay, maybe you might not say anything. Maybe you might not have a million followers to talk to. Maybe you might not have a mic with a speaker or be on radio, but your existence is resilience. And that's important to not only show up, but to be.
Yeah. Just, I was talking to one of my friends about this sort of recently. It's like just existing, just allowing yourself to sort of occupy space in a world that's trying to sort of shut you out is an act of political resistance. And I wanted them to be very self-righteous about that. And it's like even if people who are sort of in power are saying that you're not allowed to exist a certain way, then it's even more of a responsibility to push back and exist the way that is both sort of both truthful and sort of unapologetic about taking up that space. It's like, on the one hand, I want people to be safe, but also there's a real need for people to assert themselves in spaces where they know that they're going to get resistance.
Kind of going against conformity is what it means to just be true to who you are. And I think that it's not always easy, especially when stuff around you is changing or when you're in a new environment or when you're trying to find not only a safe space, but, you know, yourself and how you feel comfortable in these spaces. And I can definitely attest to that with what's going on in my neighborhood and how things are shifting, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, people deserve to live, you know, happy and fulfilling lives in their own environment. So it's sort of making just the sort of act of getting back up when they're trying to sort of legislate you out of existence.
Maybe you have a poem that speaks to that. You're listening to Living Art. Our guests tonight are Kelly Ellis and Kimberly Hall. And maybe if you want to read another poem.
Okay.
And Kelly can sort of, while you set up, explain how to find the books.
Okay. Well, mine can be bought on kellyanneellis.com, my website. And it can be obtained at Barnes & Noble or Amazon. And then Kimberly's is available on our website. And that's hotpoet.org, and it can be ordered there. And Kimberly will also be featuring at First Friday, and we'll have books there for sale. And we're trying to set up some other opportunities for her to read throughout the Houston area and really get out there and share her work. So, and we hope to get it more broadly available, but we just have to – it's a learning thing for me to figure it out as I go along.
It's a learning curve for all of us. I have a poem called Watershed, which is sort of my response to the sort of questions of why you continue to live in an environment where that is actively hostile. So, Watershed. Like every child of the Gulf Coast, I once learned every name for flood by heart. First, from natural history, which I read the way my grandmother took gospel. Names like Eddie, West Nile, Navasota. Then houseguests, Josephine, Allison, Rita, and Matthew, and Harvey. Every season, swept through the door with new faces for rain, new sounds, and waves to taste. I would sit quiet in my second floor room and hold their saturated shapes in my mouth like cough drops. Or the little alligators that we saw once down around the bayou, nestled so sweet in their mother's deep jaws. An unsuspecting observer might anticipate tragedy, that dreadful maw snapping down, the little crunch of bones under the weight of the sky. Why don't they just move, one might say. Higher ground, safer shores, flee, little animals, get out of the way. These scaly giants, they don't care if you swim or you drown. Don't you see the world is dissolving beneath your feet? Don't you see? Of course we see. But we also know better than to trust first impressions and short exposures. We know that everything true in the world that has ever been exposed by time was first exposed by water. By constructive interference, corrosion, erosion, and weathering, exposed the way the ocean exposes the seabed before storm surge, the way the river exposes our insides as we carry them flowing through its mouth. It's a myth that all rivers must flow south, but it's also not the whole story. Scylla breaks and rebuilds by the day. Hurricanes turn themselves against the clock, while Charybdis doesn't care about contemporary physics. The real myth is that anything can flow backwards. The truth is, moment to moment, the whole world is irreversible. To pretend otherwise is folly at best and at worst a curse. The truth is, levees will break and eggs will crack. Streets and rivers and houses and nests will flood. And when they do, when the skies crash and those great oily giants look down on us from above, well, the truth is, our waterlogged roots run deep, no matter what any billionaires or other invasive species might say. The truth is, American alligators have an average bite force of at least 2,000 PSI, and they use those same deadly jaws to sing lullabies to their children, all birdsong and thunder and gentle cradle. The truth is, we stay because we know the best way to hold something you love is with your teeth.
Amazing.
Thank you.
Wow.
You such got me three times.
Love that poem.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I wasn't angry about the Hurricane Harvey response when I wrote that. What are you talking about?
Yeah. It was nothing going on with the what should have happened or what I thought. But it's again just these beautiful pictures that have these juxtaposing elements, but I think it speaks to the nature of what's natural, of how things should coexist with each other, of how things are, and how they persist and with that resilience. So, yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah, thanks. It was, you know, watching so many, like, was sort of watching so many people sort of respond to what was happening in sort of in the Houston area with Hurricane Harvey, and sort of a real lack of compassion sometimes. And it's like, there's this idea that, you know, people who live in a conservative state, they deserve disaster because they deserve what the government's going to do to them because the government, like, you know, they elected the government in. And it's like, well, we live in a human society that we need to take care of each other. So it's not about sort of in times of disaster, it's not about bringing each other down. It's about lifting each other up. I wanted to sort of speak to the resilience of these communities that are just getting devastated by natural disaster, and those disasters are only going to get worse because of climate change. We already know that hurricanes are increasing in frequency and intensity. There's a real sort of corporate pushback to speaking on climate change as something that we can sort of protect ourselves against. And as such, there's also political pushback, especially in a deeply conservative state where, you know, oil barons still have a lot of power with politicians.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah, don't even get me started. Yeah, about that. Yeah, I was going to ask you to look to pick apart a few of the lines for me to do my homework, but I think I'm going to ask Kelly to read again because it's y'all's hour and...
Well, I was actually going to ask Kimberly if she would read the last poem in her book because it's just such a hopeful and uplifting poem. But also, I don't know. I just love that poem.
Okay.
Would you?
It's y'all's hour, so I just want to make sure everything's good with you.
Okay. And you can ask me to pick apart some lines.
Oh,
I'm happy
one
to do
line.
That.
Do I have time? How much? Yeah. This one line about, we know that everything true in the world that has ever been exposed by time was first exposed by water.
Yeah.
I mean, that's such a curious line because time is such a abstract and like
time is abstract and water is physical.
Yeah.
So we think of things happening over time, like when sort of in hindsight. Hindsight obviously is 2020. So we think of things that happen sort of through the past as being inevitable, but really, sort of my thought on that. I'm also hugely into geology, so I was thinking of the way that water erodes and weathers stone, and how that can cut something as huge as the Grand Canyon.
And in a way, water predates time as much as humans like carry time.
Yeah, it's time cool. as we know it is a construct.
Yeah.
There is a sort of a physical aspect to time now that we know because of all of the research done with gravitational waves. But I was really thinking of the way that water sort of cuts through things physically in a way that time doesn't.
Well, you turn the Bible on its ear for me, because it's like first comes time, then water, but you put like water first, and it seems true just on the surface to me. It's like, oh, why didn't God think of that?
Water existed before humans, and therefore before a conception of God.
Anyway, I guess we better get to your last poem.
So the last poem that's in this collection, Honey Locust, is it's a poem I wrote a really long time ago, but revisited since then multiple times. It gets its name from a piece of classical music that you probably would recognize if you listen to it. It's called On the Nature of Daylight by Max Richter. It's been in a lot of films. But it's a string piece that is really trying to evoke a sunrise, very sort of impressionistically, very gently evoke a sunrise. And I wanted to sort of evoke that feeling of there being sort of just enough light and just enough warmth that we can, that it's like the world is waking up. Here, On the Nature of Daylight. Imagine this, a small, close planet, soft and muted and blurry, awakening to itself. The first ray of sunlight peaks over the horizon, no brighter than a candle, no louder than the promise of birdsong on the wind. The horizon stretches like a blanket, tender and warm beneath your fingertips. Take a deep breath. Make space for it, inside you, not space as in emptiness, a hollow simply to be filled and exhausted, space as in airs, as in areas, space as in resonance, reminiscence, rolling clouds just below your ribs, where even silence vibrates into the most gentle crescendo. Listen closely. This is the voice of the dawn, of the world taking its own deep breath, making its own space inside its chest, space as in chords, as in fifths, space as in strings and strains and song, as in a small, close planet coming alive. Listen, listen closely. There is space enough for us too. Wow, silence.
Everybody's beautiful. Leaning into their radio right now, I'm pretty sure, trying
softly,
to listen.
As in a morning sunrise.
Well, you're the string person, you're the guitar player.
I know, which is why a lot of these pictures that are painted are so beautiful. I think I don't know what is the word for painting a picture, but when it's very descriptive enough to make to take me there with you.
You saying I write poetry. Purple prose?
I'm saying it's good and it worked on me.
Thank you. I play the violin. I listen to a lot of classical music. I listen to a lot of contemporary classical music. So it's something that is it creates strong images and sensations for me, and it's a real challenge to try to put that into words.
I bet. To hit the emotion. Kelly, you've requested that poem.
I did. I love that poem.
Give us the answer key or whatever it is.
Well, there's no answer key, but I just think it's a beautiful way to end the book. And the book is beautiful, so I suggest everyone should get a copy.
Please give me money. Support your local artists.
Indeed. We've got about, what, four minutes?
We've got about 3 minutes.
That was
left.
Very, very erotic, too, I thought.
Oh, gosh, thanks.
If you had a lover, that would be something the lover would take and cherish.
You looking out the window with your significant other at the sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very intimate poem, really. Even if it's just, an intimacy between the viewer and the sunrise, an alone moment.
There's such a tactile thing where you're feeling the horizon and beautiful.
Thank you. I try to advocate for people to get comfortable being alone with themselves, to sort of really exist, take note of the way that you feel as you exist, and sort of get comfortable looking at yourself, not just sort of moving, through society with other people, just trying to reflect other people and sort of get comfortable with yourself by yourself.
I love that. I think a lot of people today live through the perception that others have of them instead of taking time to, like you said, get comfy with being who you are with the small things, like when you take a deep breath,
mm-hmm.
mindful things that we forget or don't, or really, really take for granted. So a lot of your work today has been just beautiful and painted great pictures in my mind. With this book, again, can you tell the listeners a little bit about how to find it and what else you're going to be up to in the future?
Well, find it at hotpoet.org, and that's our website. And you can also find the journal Equinox. We have a new issue coming out, and Kimberly has a poem in it. So it's also at hotpoet.org, and it's always free to the public. It's what we do to support writers and artists and build community.
All right. Well, thank you so much for stopping by Living Art tonight.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you, Michael.
All right. This is KPFT Houston. It was Kelly Ellis, Kimberly Hall. Blue, again, it was great doing a show with you. And stay tuned for Queer Voices coming up next. KPFT Houston.
I could be you.
And you could be me?
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way
to get inside
each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
KPFT Programmer Profile.
Hi there, this is Dwayne Bradley, host of the Open Journal program, Mondays at 6 p.m. It's KPFT's radio magazine of the airwaves. We have long-form conversations with interesting people